Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we'll begin with the surprising ways that Hollywood actors have shaped American politics and who have been some of the most groundbreaking and influential on the body politic. Then, how do our experiences, our traumas, diets, and lifestyles get coded in our genetic systems, then passed on to our offspring and their offspring? And how do they affect our health and our politics? In 1918, the leaders of the FBI, William Burns and J. Edgar Hoover, expressed deep concern about the power of movie stars to affect politics. And so they began a surveillance program to watch over those whom they thought might be radicals. Their surveillance revealed some stars who had become part of the so-called Red Movement. Since then, it has long seemed that Hollywood crowd was ideologically left. But our next guest says that's actually not true. Stephen Ross joins us in studio for a two-part discussion about his book, Hollywood Left and Right, which is just out in paperback. He's a historian at the University of Southern California and author of numerous books, including this one, Hollywood Left and Right. Welcome, Stephen Ross. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I think I want to start with one of your premises, and here's a quote right out of your book. Movie stars do more than just show us how to dress, look, or love. They teach us how to think and act politically. How so?
Well, I think one of the great things that movie stars do and have done since the 19-teens, is they draw attention to issues. And people who are anti-Hollywood, and it's not even conservatives, because you have a lot of conservative stars who have been political, but people who are anti-Hollywood just simply dismiss it and see it as star worship and what can they tell us, et cetera, et cetera. They miss the big point. The big point is, right from the start, when movie stars started going out on the road, starting in World War I, selling war bonds, or when they started going out on the road with candidates, what would happen, the biggest influence movie stars have had is actually they get us to think. It's not what they have to say, that our lives are busy. We often don't pay attention to things. We think things are, oh, you know, it's the same old, whether it was 1917 or today. But suddenly when somebody you get that you admire gets involved in either a cause or a candidate, it draws your attention. And once it draws your attention, you're the one who decides, am I going to actually read something about this? Am I going to listen to this person? Am I going to find more about this cause? And what has done it is, again, it's the celebrity who has brought you to it. But we're, and again, these polls, I get very upset when I read these polls about, well, is so-and-so, is Oprah's endorsement, you know, let's go back to 2008, you know, first time she endorses a candidate, is Oprah's endorsement more likely to make you vote for Obama? It's the wrong question. It's kind of like saying, when did you stop beating your husband or wife? Either way, you sound like an idiot. The real question should be, would Oprah's endorsement or any star get you to pay more attention to a candidate or an issue?
So it's the agenda setting function.
That's right, because otherwise if you say, you know, yes, it's going to get me more likely to vote, you sound like a moron, that you have no real brain. And in fact, what it is it simply gets you to pause for a moment and say, okay, let me actually think about this.
Do you think it's really because when somebody has achieved celebrity status that all of the news media then call attention to the issue? Or is it the celebrity status itself?
It's both. You know, first of all, we've now gone on 24/7 news. You know, if you notice, you go through history, all Jack Kennedy's affairs, none of them got reported at the time, A, because there was a kind of code, an ethos. But I will tell you, if Kennedy had lived through 24/7 media, that ethos would have gone out of the door because they simply needed copy. So it's gotten, in other words, there's always been a kind of celebrity worship in the media. It's always good for business. Let's remember, it's a business. The celebrity business is a business. It's not just about your fantasies. It's selling them. And so, you know, if you want to get, whether it's ratings on TV or ratings, you know, getting people to buy your newspapers, you want the kind of gossipy stuff that's going to draw attention. And celebrities draw attention.
That also brings up the kind of relationship people have with celebrities. You say it's a love-hate relationship.
Right. You can, for example, really like a movie star. And let's say you're an action kind of movie person. And you've always loved Mel Gibson. And then you find out who he really is. And suddenly, I can't tell you how many people I know said, including myself, I'll never go see a Mel Gibson movie again. And
because people thought he was the character before.
Yes, and they thought he was a certain kind of person. And what happens, and this is something William DeMille, who is the left-wing brother of Cecil DeMille, the most conservative director, talked about even in the 1930s, that we love our movie stars until they actually speak out on something controversial, and then they turn out to have feet of clay. So if you're a Democrat and you hear a Republican speaking out, or a movie star that you didn't know their politics, suddenly speaking out in a very conservative fashion, it would likely turn you off. Likewise, if you're conservative and you hear some star that you didn't know what their politics were speaking out on a left-wing agenda, you get turned off. And, you know, we can go back to Sid Grauman, who had Grauman's Chinese, who was one of the more innovative exhibitors of his time. He would warn movie stars in the 19-teens, never speak out politically, and I can sort of quote him here, never speak out politically because the moment you do, it's bad for the old box officeroo. And you can bring that all the way up to Michael Jordan at his peak was often questioned by, you know, reporters from Nation and places like this, sort of more left progressive, saying, how come you don't use your star personality to speak out on issues of importance, particularly race issues? And his response is, Republicans buy Nikes. And my response to him is, Mr. Jordan, how wealthy do you have to be? But you know what? There are people who don't want their image soiled, and it's true. The moment you open your mouth as a movie star, you are going to alienate half of your potential audience.
And you aptly point out in your book that throughout Hollywood, that this has really guided so many actors to avoid politics, and yet there were those that went forward. You picked 10 of them.
That's correct.
And 10 of them for several reasons, including their impact. 5 on the right, 5 on the left. Let's start with any common thread that you saw among them.
Well, the most interesting thing is many of them came from what you could call broken homes. And I still haven't, I'm a historian rather than a psychologist, although I often play a psychologist in everyday life. But I don't really know. It would be hard. But so many of them had Charlie Chaplin, drunken father, Louis B. Mayer, I'm going in order now, a father that would kind of beat him and accuse him of working too hard rather than going and studying the Talmud. Edward G. Robinson, a father that didn't hurt him in any way, but he never talked about his girlfriends. And he didn't even have a girlfriend until he was like 30, and he was afraid to bring her home because she was a shiksa, you know, non-Jew. And you can go to Reagan, and these are the people I'm talking about in order of my book. Reagan and Murphy both had, Murphy's father died early. Reagan's father was an alcoholic. You move ahead to Jane Fonda, Henry Fonda, one of the worst fathers in Hollywood. Charlton Heston coming from a broken home. Harry Belafonte, a father who left the family very early on. Warren Beatty, a father who had trouble with alcohol. Arnold Schwarzenegger, a father who was rough on the kids. Everyone seemed to have difficult fathers. Now, how you figure that, you ask me what's the common thread? That's one of them. The other thing, if there's a common thread in the more admirable, it's that all 10 were willing to take a risk. And that is something rare. All 10 of them understood that speaking out politically could hurt them in the box office. Even Louis B. Mayer, it could hurt his studio. But all 10 of them felt it was incumbent upon them as a citizen. And to that extent, that's why I say I really admire all 10 politically. I may not like their politics, and in the case of Louis B. Mayer, I may not like him personally, but I admire somebody who is willing to do that risk, who's willing to put their money where their mouth is.
Now, Louis B. Mayer, first of all, I'm going to ask you to remind listeners who he is. It seemed that he was the one that used politics to help his business more than the others.
Yes. Well, Louis B. Mayer was the head of MGM Studios, really the first head. And what people don't know, one of the things I bring in the book is I deal with two what I call myths of Hollywood. And that led me to have these counterintuitive theses that, again, I like to write books about things I don't know, so I get surprised. And the sort of common wisdom about Hollywood is it's filled with lefties and liberals, and that it's always been this way. It's always been the bastion of the left. And one of the things I found was first that conservatives have a longer history in Hollywood than liberals do. And second, that even though the Hollywood left has been more numerous and visible, the Hollywood right has actually had a greater impact on American political life and on the nature of the American state. And it really starts with Louis B. Mayer, because he is really the first key political figure in Hollywood. You have Charlie Chaplin before then, who's making what I call anti-authoritarian films. But Chaplin is sort of on his own. Mayer is the first person to create a relationship between a studio and a political party. He is the man who brings the Republican Party into Hollywood, and he brings Hollywood into the Republican Party. And he turns MGM into a publicity wing of the GOP. And he goes on, he's serious enough that he goes on to become the head of the California GOP. He's a power broker at the 1928 presidential primaries. He strikes a deal, a secret deal between Herbert Hoover and William Randolph Hearst, that gives Hoover enough delegates to get the nomination on the first ballot. And Mayer, a number of his films also take a very, as opposed to the Warner Brothers, which kind of take a left liberal point of view of American life, Mayer's studio really puts forth a conservative ideology. And as I write about in the book, nothing more on the nose for today's conservative politics than the one series he put his heart into, which was the Hardy Family series, the most successful series in MGM history. And if you watch these movies, starring Mickey Rooney, and some of them have Judy Garland, but some of them not, what you see is it's Ronald Reagan's, it is the basis of Reagan's Morning in America. It's God, family, and country are all we need. And you never need to rely on the government. You need to rely on God, family, patriotism, and your sort of home community. And that will solve all the problems. It's not government. It's the sort of local people pulling together. And he does it in a very appealing fashion. And it does it in a fashion that you want to believe it, because then everything's going to be fine.
The other interesting thing about him was what he did to sort of catapult the Republican Party in terms of bringing in tactics, like you mentioned, the dirty politics. How did he do that?
Well, the other, again, what I was surprised by, it's been the Republicans and the conservatives, not the liberals and Democrats, who have actually pioneered the uses of mass media for political ends. two things Mayer did early on, well, three things he did early on that were really interesting. The first is, as I mentioned, he turned MGM into a publicity wing of the Republican Party. And what do I mean by that? Anytime a famous Republican figure would come through L.A., whether it was a congressperson, a senator, a governor, president, Mayer would find out who their favorite actor, actresses were. He, whether they were at MGM or not, he would bring them onto the studio lot. He would build a special set for a lunch. He would put the candidate on his dais and then put the two movie stars on either side of him. He would then make sure he had his studio photographers come in. Excuse me. And the next day, a picture of that politician and these famous movie stars would go out on every wire service throughout the country, giving that politician a patina of glamour that any potential opponent would lack. So, you know, you get a politician with Mary Pickford or Douglas Fairbanks or one of his people there. And, you know, that was, he understood the power of glamour and publicity and using it for politics. Mayer was also put in charge of the 1928 Republican convention to make it lively. And the 24 convention was broadcast on some radios, and it was considered an island of dullness. And even though we can't imagine, well, how can you make radio exciting? He tried to create a program at the committee filled with bands, filled with balloons coming down, filled with a sense of excitement, so that when listeners heard it on the radio, what they heard were bands, they heard fanfare, they heard that this was something really exciting and that they could imagine it. that he turned politics into the excitement of the imagination. And it would be his protege, George Murphy, who would instruct Republicans. He was really the first one. He tried in 48 with Dewey, who wouldn't listen to him, Thomas Dewey, who ran against Truman. And that was the famous election where Dewey got too arrogant, thinking he was so far ahead he couldn't lose. And he did. And Murphy was trying to say, no, you come across on TV terribly. And when Ike ran in 52, Murphy and Robert Montgomery became Ike's TV consultants. But the other thing he did was dirty tricks that in many ways preceded the Kerry Bush campaign, where in 1934, Upton Sinclair, a longtime socialist, switched over to the Democratic Party, figuring he's never going to win as a socialist, but maybe he could win as a Democrat, was running for governor, and it looked like he was on the path to win. And Mayer came back from a European vacation and came to a studio because he was alerted to the fact that this was going to be bad for business, that Sinclair City was going to raise taxes on the studios. And so he sent out a reporter to do these semi-fake newsreels. And what they did is they sent this the roving reporter around the state, and he would interview people. There were three candidates, Republican, Democrat, and a sort of third dark horse figure. And the main opposition was the Republican Merriam. And what he did is he would have staged actors. So, for example, he had the reporter interviewing a black Republican, a man who is in front of his home, clearly a homeowner, white shirt, because costuming matters, how you present somebody, a bow tie, totally clean. Who are you going to vote for? I'm going to vote for Merriam, because he will give us jobs, and I've done well for myself through hard work and blah, blah, blah. And you see, he's got his home, or at least it appears that way. And then they go to talk to some black voters who might be voting for Sinclair, and they walk up to a car, and there's a bunch of African-Americans in the car, and when they roll down the window, all the smoke comes out, and you know they've been smoking weed in the car. It's so clear. And who are you voting for? Oh, man, we're going to vote for Sinclair. And the same thing, they get immigrants. They have an immigrant. Who are you going to vote for? And the one immigrant who says he's going to vote for Merriam is well-dressed. He speaks with a slight accent. But then the guy who's going to be for Sinclair speaks like he's a Russian revolutionary. And, you know, it was Sinclair is going to support the same kind of program they had in Russia. And it was good for there, and it's going to be good for here. So it's all these faked interviews that make it seem like if you vote for Sinclair, you're going to bring the communist revolution to America. And as a result of that, as well as Hearst running a similar smear campaign where he's showing all these bums coming in, saying that they're coming in because Sinclair's promising work for all of us, until somebody points out in a rival newspaper that the photograph that Sinclair had of the bums coming in Hearst's newspaper was actually a still from Warner Brothers, Wild Boys of the Road. So they had to run a retraction that, in fact, it wasn't true. But this is something Mayer pioneered and the Republicans would use over the years. They understood, how do you use media, even in a dirty way, to sway popular opinion?
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with historian Stephen Ross about his book, Hollywood Left and Right, which is just out in paperback. One of the things that I noticed that seemed like a theme is that those actors and movie stars who were on the right and conservative side seemed to continue on with more or less a successful life, whereas those that were more on the left were sort of demonized at some point, you know, whether it was Jane Fonda or whether it was Charlie Chaplin, and they seemed to have a much more difficult time.
Yes, and part of that has to do with the question of war. If there's a lesson here, it's if you come out ahead of public opinion on a war, and particularly opposition to the war, you are going to be demonized. And Ellen Goodman had a line that I love. We give medals to movie stars on the right and FBI dossiers to movie stars on the left. So you think that the careers of Charlie Chaplin and Edward G. Robinson were ruined because they were what Hueck and the Red Scare would later call premature anti-fascists, one of the most ridiculous phrases I've ever heard in my life. that during the 1930s, they were urging us to support the Allied cause and to oppose fascism. And they were joining with groups, particularly Robinson, and very later on, after he made The Great Dictator, Chaplin joined in. And we have this myth of the good war. We have this idea that Americans recognized Hitler immediately and knew how evil he was. And it is a myth, because in November 1936, you had something like 95% of the American population against any involvement with what was happening in Europe. And even as late as July 1941, and now we're talking almost 2 years into the war, you had 79% of Americans who had seen Hitler, had seen Mussolini, had seen what they were doing. They still wanted nothing to do with the war. So in a way, people like Chaplin, people like Edward G. Robinson, and many of the blacklisted, the Hollywood Ten, should have been applauded later on, saying, you know, you guys told us what was right and wrong, and you saw it early. But instead, their careers were over because they were seen as aligned with communists. And the same thing would happen to Jane Fonda during the Vietnam War. You can get, one could argue to this day, you know, people like Sean Penn, Susan Sarandon, Tim Robbins, you know, came under terrible fire for their opposition to Iraq. And the irony is, every one of these left stars who suffered because they talked about anti-war in one case or getting involved in fighting fascism, history shows every one of them was right, and yet every one of them gets punished.
One of your more conservative actors actually collaborated with the Nazi government in some ways, bringing over the newspaper
right.
editors.
Right, well, kowtow is the word I would use. Starting in 1934, Adolf Hitler told the Hollywood studios that any one of you who has an office in Germany needs to fire any of your Jewish employees. We will not tolerate it. And if you don't fire those employees, we will not allow your studio to exhibit any of its films, either in Germany or any area we control. And every single studio except for Warner Brothers went along with it. They fired the Jewish employees. Warner Brothers responded by shutting down their operation, shutting down their office in Germany and moving it to England. And part of the reason is the studios were making 30 to 40% of their profits from foreign distribution, and they didn't want to risk their profits. And the incident you're mentioning is in June 1939. There are 10 Nazi newspaper editors touring L.A., and Mayer welcomes them onto the MGM lot and gives them a tour of the studio. And I saw some correspondence in the Warner Brothers files of somebody writes to Harry Warner saying, can't you talk to this guy? He's crazy. How can he tour these Nazis? You're a Jew. And Warner writes back saying, you know, Louis B. Mayer is going to do whatever he wants. No one can tell him what to do.
Let's back up a little bit and precede Mayer and go to Charlie Chaplin. Would you say he was the pioneer in using his film to affect the Americans politically?
He was a pioneer, yes. He's what I call the first political movie star. And that is, his politics were very eclectic, but they were kind of definitely left. And what I call, he was an instinctual radical. That, you know, he dropped out of school in elementary school. He was an autodidact. He taught himself everything. He was quite a bright man, but not consistent. He considered himself a socialist. At the time, he was the wealthiest man in Hollywood. And at the same time, he was, because of his upbringing, he was always pathologically afraid of being plunged back into poverty. And people who knew him well talked about his pathological cheapness. That I interviewed somebody, Larry Bachman, who used to play tennis with him. Chaplin was a little older. Bachman was on the tennis team at USC in the 1920s. And he told me Charlie Chaplin could break his arm reaching away from a check. But
it came from the poverty he came
yes.
from, though, right? It's like people who grew up in poverty often can't lose it.
Well, he grew up in something worse than poverty, which is when he was really small, his family was actually fairly well-to-do. They had a multi-bedroom apartment with a maid. And then his father started drinking again. The parents split up. His mother got sick. And they eventually wound up going from poorer to poorer to poorer circumstances until she was sent finally to an insane asylum, and he and his brother were sent to a workhouse. And at that point, they were in total poverty. And so he was always afraid. And yet, when you watch his early films, they are what I call anti-authoritarian, that he begins, in a sense, getting his instinctual politics. He doesn't want to do it left-right on the nose, but instead, his early films are constantly attacking authority figures up and down the class ladder, from employers to landlords to judges. Anyone who gives the working class people and immigrants a hard time really comes in for attack. And it's only by the 1930s, as he's by the 1920s starts touring the world, and he realizes world leaders, major intellectual leaders, and H.G. Wells, people like this, they all want to talk to him. George Bernard Shaw, they want to talk to him about ideas. And it's not until the 1930s that he has enough self-confidence that his films become much more politically focused. So he'll make Modern Times in 1936, and then The Great Dictator in 1940. And then after the war, he really goes to town and makes Monsieur Verdu and a number of films that get him totally into trouble. Where his films are being boycotted, he's being protested, and that's when he leaves the country.
We will continue our conversation with Stephen Ross on Hollywood Left and Right next week. This is The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and next up, how does what we eat and what we experience get passed on to our offspring and their offspring? Stay tuned.
You and me ain't no movie star. What we are is what we are. We share a bed. Enough for a working man. What I am is what I am. And I tell you, baby, well, that's enough for me.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. For many years, geneticists and psychologists have worked in separate labs on the factors such as our genetic codes and our experiences that they each thought were affecting our physical and mental health, respectively. But it may be that our experiences are affecting our epigenetics, which can then get handed down for generations to come, contributing to diseases and behaviors such as cancer, diabetes, depression, and PTSD. How does all this work? Three experts join us. Eva Jablonka is a professor at Tel Aviv University and co-author of several books, including Evolution in Four Dimensions, Genetic, Epigenetic, Behavioral, and Symbolic Variation in the History of Life. Randy Jertl is a professor at Duke University and the University of Wisconsin and co-author of Environmental Epigenetics and Health and Disease, Epigenetics and Complex Diseases. Patrick McGowan also joins us. Patrick McGowan is a professor of neuroscience at the University of Toronto, studying epigenetic changes in the brain. Thank you so much for being with us. Eva Jablonka, let's start with you, particularly because of the title and subtitle of a book you co-authored, Evolution in Four Dimensions, Genetic, Epigenetic, Behavioral, and Symbolic Variation in the History of Life. You've looked at this as how we develop biologically, psychologically. How do you see these four dimensions fitting together and working together to determine our development?
If a human being is looking at itself and thinking about, why am I the way I am? Why do I have the traits that I have? Why do I behave the way that I do behave? What's making me tick? And then one begins to think, well, what are the inputs into my development? What kind of inputs are there? And we're used to think, we thought for a very long time, that the most important input is the genetic input. The genes make you what you are. You are the way that you are because you have a particular genetic constitution. Now, there is no doubt that the particular genetic constitution that one has is one very important input into development. But of course, we know that the environment, too, is very important because it is the interaction between the environment and, as I shall elaborate, it's not only the environment in which one has been developing oneself, but also the environment of one's ancestors, that is very important, that this interaction with the genotype is what is, with the genes, is what makes us what we are. So what are the other inputs? So we were thinking, well, let's start with the, do we only get genes, DNA sequences from our parents? And of course we do get a lot more. We get also all kinds of epigenetic marks from our parents, which are carried in the egg and in the sperm. For example, all kinds of marks on the DNA, DNA methylation marks, some marks on the proteins around which the DNA is wrapped are also transmitted with the egg and the sperm and affect our development. So we're getting all this epigenetic marks, these things that are above, epi is above the genome. So that's a second kind of development, a very important developmental input, which we're getting from our parents. And this input, this epigenetic input, depends on what happened to our parents, what genes were active in our parents, what genes were inactive, and the genes that were active or inactive, which genes were active and inactive, this depends on their own experiences, on their lives, on what they went through. Now, okay, so this is the second dimension, the epigenetic dimension, which is a dimension of both heredity and development, because the interaction that we have with the world changes our epigenetics, and we also start with a particular epigenetic constitution in addition to the genetic constitution. So two things happen with us. Again, the first is that we get a particular genetic and epigenetic constitution from our parents, and the second is that this epigenotype is changing as we interact with the environment. It is dynamic. It is in flux. Now, the other thing that is important for development is what happens in the womb. We are mammals. And what happens in the womb may be very important for the way that we will develop. For example, the food that the mother eats, the kind of whether or not she was under psychological and nutritional stress, can make a difference to the development of her offspring. Sometimes it can even make a difference to the development of her grandchildren. But certainly it will make a difference to the development of her offspring. When we're thinking about early development, we're getting care and love and food and all kinds of other inputs from our parents. This early input has a very, very important effect on our development. And again, this can be not only about the development of us as the offspring of our parents, but also on our own children, on the grandchildren of our parents. And then there is the symbolic dimension. This is a dimension that we all live in as human beings. This is, for example, language. We transmit a lot of information through language. We learn things through language, through symbolic systems. This is something which is very unique to humans, and there's no doubt that the kind of culture, the symbolic culture in which we live, is something that constructs us, makes us into what we are. It is part of this totality. So we have the genetic system, the epigenetic system, the behavioral system, the things that make us behave, which are not dependent on symbols, that may be dependent, for example, on food preferences that we have, on the hormonal constitution that was affected by, for example, what our parents went through, and the symbolic dimensions. And all this together make us what we are. And they also not only make us what we are, they not only affect development, they can also affect heredity, the next generation. And because they can affect heredity, they can also affect evolution.
Let's bring Randy Jertl in now. This is kind of a perfect setup for some of the work you've been doing, particularly with passing on particular traits and characteristics by what the mother eats when she's pregnant. How does this affect the offspring and the offspring of the offspring?
Before I get into that, I came from an engineering background, so it's better for me to set up things in simple ways. I really think of genome and the epigenome like being a computer and the programs that are running in that computer. So I think of the genome as being comparable to the hardware of a computer, and the epigenome, which is what we're talking about mainly today, is the software that tells that computer when, where, and how to work. Now, we got into this because we were studying the phenomena of genomic imprinting, and this is a phenomena where one copy of a gene is silenced epigenetically, usually through methylation. mutation in histone marks, it's shut down. So only one functional copy. And we wanted to determine really whether or not epigenetics played a role in what is called the fetal origins of adult disease susceptibility. And we did these studies really back in the beginning of around 2002, 2003. And this was when Rob Waterlin was in my laboratory as a postdoc. And he wanted to look at this because he was a nutritionist and the effect of nutrition could potentially have on the epigenome and then maybe potentially have on disease susceptibility. And to test this, we chose a very interesting model system. And that model system, when you're on radio, you can't see things as well, but I want the audience to think on the left-hand side, you have a yellow, beautiful yellow blonde animal that's obese, and on the right-hand side, you have a brown animal that's very, very thin. But these animals are genetically identical because they've been bred such that the genomes don't vary, but yet their characteristics are hugely different, not only the coat colors, but also their susceptibility to obesity, diabetes, and cancer. The blonde animals become obese, morbidly obese, and they get diabetes and cancer, whereas the brown animals are mean, lean, and clean all of their life. So what we did is we exposed the mother then to supplements in the diets, and these are supplements like folic acid, choline, betaine, vitamin B12. Why those compounds? Because those are the compounds that donate these little methyl groups, which is a carbon with three little hydrogens on it, that are then attached on directly onto the DNA. And we asked the question then, can we, when we do this, shift the distribution of the offspring by altering the mother's diet? And not only that, can we do that by altering the methylation patterns in a region that we knew was controlling this characteristic that we were seeing? And indeed, we showed that very clearly. So for the very first time, we had linked, basically, what the mother ate very early in life, right at these marks were placed in the embryo, probably right after fertilization. So we linked that very early time point in development with disease susceptibility in the offspring as adults through alterations in what we call the epigenome, or methylations in these histone marks, rather than changes in the genome. This then is the memory system, at least in this mouse system. This is the memory system that enables something that occurred literally right after fertilization to affect your disease susceptibility throughout your whole life.
Does that go on to the offspring of the offspring?
With this model system, it does, and that's been shown by other people. In other words, when it's passed through the mother, these marks are not taken off. So there's what's called a transgenerational inheritance of these epigenetic changes. And when it's passed at this one particular area of the genome, when it's passed to the father, the marks are taken off. So my point that I'm making is sometimes the marks aren't taken off efficiently, sometimes they are removed. But the important point is that there are many situations where these marks are not removed, so you have the potential then for a transgenerational inheritance of epigenetic phenomena that is being produced in response to the environment. So what we were studying was early developmental environment, because that's when those marks are put down for differentiation and all the characteristics that we have. The genome in every cell, the DNA of the computer basically in the cell, is exactly the same. One copy from mom, one from dad. But yet we have 250 to 300 different cell types. And the reason we have that is because there's basically been developmentally programs established that tell one cell to be a liver cell, one to be a skin cell, one to be an eyeball cell, etc. So in effect, I really think of cells as being little mini programmable computers.
Patrick McGowan, you look at mental health issues, suicidal behavior, mood disorders, depression. How do you see these developing epigenetically?
Well, I just to start, you know, to pick up from what Randy was saying, one of the things that fascinated me as a student, I was a student in psychology, not in engineering like Randy, but so one of the classic debates was that of nature versus nurture, right? So how much of your behavior can be attributed to the genes that you carry from your ancestors, and how much can be attributed by the environment that you experience in life? And the way that epigenetics has come into the equation is to suggest that both of these things are intimately linked, and it's really difficult, and in some cases impossible, to separate them out. And we know that from studies of, for example, of identical twins, which are like like what Dr. Gerald was talking about in terms of his identical mice. We have nature has provided us with examples in humans where we have two individuals that have exactly the same genome, and yet in a lot of cases in terms of mental health outcomes, like depression, for example. Depression is something where if you see one twin with depression, there's maybe about a 50% chance that the other twin will show depression at some point in his life or her life. And so there's a significant contribution of things other than genetics. And it was always assumed that those things were differences in the environment the two twins experience. But it's become clear over the number of years that there's another layer of information on top of the genetic information, and that serves as kind of an interface between the environment and the genes, which is this epigenetic layer of information. And so what I've been studying is, my work has been focused more on stress and the role of changes in epigenetics in stress as a way to study some of the major antecedents of mental disorders like depression or anxiety disorder, for example, that where we know stress plays a major role. And in particular, in the early life environment, you know, during development, stress can have a major impact that lasts throughout the life of the person. And now we're coming to understand that occurs in part, at least, through changes in the epigenetics of the individual rather than changes strictly in the environment, because the environment can change. The individual can go from being very poor early in life, for example, being very rich. But some of those epigenetic marks from the early life stay with that person throughout their life.
So what you're essentially suggesting is perhaps it's not so much psychological mind. There is an actual physical component, which is probably what makes it difficult to change these things.
Yeah, there's absolutely. I mean, something like depression, for example, is absolutely a physical disease. Depression doesn't just affect your behavior, but it affects all kinds of systems in the body, everything from, you know, your blood pressure, for example, the function of your liver. There's a variety of physical outcomes from depression that occur in part because what you're changing is you're changing all the variety of hormones that are involved in response to stress. So from that standpoint, if we can understand how changes in something like the stress system can stay with us.
And then get passed on to the offspring.
And then potentially get passed on to the offspring. I mean, there's a fascinating area of research in post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, where at least anecdotally for a number of years it's been noted that the offspring of people who've experienced severe trauma, for example, Holocaust survivors, their offspring have a much different response to stress than the offspring of people who haven't had that in their history. And the question is how to explain that. Well, some of the answer, perhaps, is in epigenetic changes. And studies from animal models, for example, suggest that traumatic experiences might alter, for example, the information that the father passes on to its offspring through several generations as a result of that trauma, through changes in these epigenetic marks. So with humans, it's very difficult to do these kinds of experiments. But at least the animal models are suggesting that some of the same kinds of processes could occur in humans. And that might offer some great explanatory power and also some ways of changing the kinds of therapies that we use to remediate these effects.
Just a reminder that this is the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about how factors like our experiences, traumas, diets, and lifestyles get passed on to our offspring and their offspring. In essence, what we're saying is that the genes themselves are not necessarily the simple cause for these traits and illnesses, and it's not really just the environment either. It's this kind of dynamic that ultimately expresses itself physically. Eva Jablanka.
It's not the DNA sequence of the gene. It is the gene expression pattern. It is the activity of the gene. And the activity of the gene depends on this epigenetic mark, on the chromatin, on the way that the DNA is wound around the protein, in its methylation, all kinds of biochemical factors that make the chromatin, not just the DNA sequence, but also other components of the cell, into make the components of the DNA and the bound proteins and the bound chemical groups into an active or inactive gene. So it is not the DNA sequence of the gene, but it is the gene activity which is important. And what we thought for a very long time was that it is only the sequence, the DNA sequence, that is inherited from one generation to the next. The particular gene activity pattern is not inherited. It is reset every generation. And this is the change. We now realize that it is not always reset, that sometimes what happened in the past in previous generations can be inherited. So if you think the kind of analogy that Marion Lamb and I gave in our book, and that is if you think about the genome as notes, musical notes, and you think about the gene expression as the actual music played by players with the instruments and so on. So we thought that only the notes are inherited from one generation to the next. Now we know that we have another technology, like taping. Yes, the particular interpretation can be of a particular piece of music, if you want, can be passed on from one generation to the next. So it is not just the DNA sequence, the structure, but also the activity that can be inherited.
Randy Jertl, what does this mean for treatment of these diseases like cancer or even obesity? Can the medical community now understand and figure out how to manipulate the epigenetics rather than killing off the particular tumor?
Before I answer that question, I just wanted to make, I think, an important point, too, is that the epigenome in its vulnerability varies with stage of development. So the most vulnerable time is when the epigenome is being established, which is really literally right after birth during that early first trimester. But it can be altered in adulthood, as been discussed previously. And the other problem is that when you get older, it's probable that your epigenome is not maintained as well. And one of the earliest changes that occurs, now I get to your answer of your question, is the earliest changes in cancer formation are epigenetic changes. And as a consequence, that destabilizes not only the epigenome, but results in potentially more mutations, et cetera, which gives rise to tumors. And as a consequence, you know, you've got yourself a problem if you've got one of those. But if you actually think about the fact that it's not just genetically driven, but also potentially and is epigenetically driven, then your way in which your armamentarium in which you can actually treat tumors enhances, because you now have the potential of not just cytotoxically killing them with chemotherapeutic agents or with radiation or surgically removing them, but you also have the potential of developing compounds that alter the epigenome, because in cancer, for example, one way in which these tumor suppressors, which are brakes that inhibit cells from growing when they're inappropriately, often those tumor suppressors are mutated so they become non-functional. But another way that you can eliminate its function is by epigenetically silencing it, so it no longer works even though the gene is there. So you can now develop, and there are people have developed compounds that can be used now to open up these epigenetic marks and allow for those tumor suppressors which have been inappropriately silenced to be expressed. And often what happens then is it induces the cell to undergo what's called programmed cell death, which is called apoptosis. So it's just another way in which you can potentially treat cancers. And I think it's going to be, in the future, a very, very powerful way to treat cancer. It's also potentially a way in which one can treat some developmental disorders, because there are a number of developmental disorders of which mind even and neurological problems and disorders, even maybe autism and schizophrenia, where you've got the dysregulation of these imprinted genes or a mutation in the only functional copy of the gene. Well, you have a normal copy. It's already there. So again, epigenetic therapy potentially could open up that silenced copy because it's perfectly fine. The other one's mutated, and then we have a problem, you know, a developmental problem, neurological issue, etc. But if you could open up that normal copy, you would now have epigenetic gene therapy, but you don't have to put the gene in there. It's already there. You just got it to get it to work. And people have already determined topoisomerase inhibitors, for example, are able to do this, at least in some of these neurological and developmental disorders. So it's a whole new field therapy that's now just starting.
So what about then for some of these other disorders like depression, like PTSD, suicidal behavior, other mood problems? How is the therapy changing there? Patrick McGowan.
There's been an explosion in research in cancer biology in particular in terms of epigenetic drugs and drugs that change the epigenome. And people are starting to look at what are the effects of these drugs, if we use them in animal models, of some mental disorders, like depression, for example. And it turns out that some of these drugs do have the ability to, as either adjuvants to a standard therapy for depression, like an SSRI, for example, like a Prozac, or on their own can alter the epigenome and then also alter some of the symptoms of these of mental disorders. What we know, though, is that a lot of the time, these drugs are what we call very dirty drugs. They have very broad effects. And what we need to do is we need to figure out how to target these drugs to the right places in the genome, which is a big challenge, to be able to alter the epigenome of the genes that we want to alter and not affect broad-scale other kinds of genes. But there's been some fascinating research in neuroscience, for example, that's shown that some of these drugs, at least in animal studies, can reverse some of the effects of stress on the behaviors that we associate with anxiety and depression.
Patrick McGowan, you said something earlier that I'm a political scientist, changes how social science can think about phenomena like war, genocide. People who have experienced an extraordinary trauma like a genocide survivors, then passing on this epigenetic phenomena onto their offspring and their offspring, thereby kind of creating an overreaction to particular stimuli, environmental factors. Can we use these new studies to try to understand perhaps the causes of ongoing war and conflict? Do you think that there's a connection there?
One of the fascinating questions is in terms of how people become, which people are resistant to the kinds of stresses that they experience during war and what makes them resistant to those kinds of stresses. I think part of the answer lies in epigenetics because, you know, not everyone who experiences a suicide bomb, for example, gets post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a huge issue to try to understand this in returning vets in the U.S., for example. Where we've got a substantial proportion of people coming back that don't show maybe physical problems associated with their time in the war region. But then, you know, it turns out that they may have mental disorders that are associated with this. And this is where I think it's necessary to view these as really a physical disorder, and mental disorders are just as much of a physical disorder as anything else. And it's a fascinating area to contemplate, to sort of think that we can start to try to understand at the level of physiology what's been changed in these individuals or what makes them less resistant to the effects of stress in the battlefield than other people. You know, we're far ways from understanding that, but we have some clues.
Eva Jablonka.
So I just want to say something about your question. I think that one of the things that for me are becoming clearer is that indeed things such as wars and chronic kind of stress, I'm living in a region which experiences this kind of stress, and malnutrition, which goes on for many generations, is very, very, which again, there are populations that are experiencing it. I think this kind of stresses have transgenerational effects. And I think that we have to study these things, that it is possible to study these things. It is possible to see how people who are living in this kind of condition, how their epigenome looks and what kind of effect it has on their behavior, on their temperament, on their ability to cope with stress, on their resilience to stress, because there may be also not only that things are just inherited in a simple kind of way, there may be also compensatory kind of changes in the epigenome of offspring. There are all kinds of possibilities, and I think that it is enormously important to try and understand this kind of things, because otherwise we will not be able to cope intelligently with the effects of the stresses and the effects of the social, political stresses. And so I think that we can talk about, in a way, about the biology of culture and the culture of biology.
Randy Jertle?
Yeah, I just have one comment that I'd like to make, and I mean, I use animal models all the time, but I want to make a point that's very, very, I think, very, extremely important. Though animal models can be incredibly important in defining how things work, et cetera, and mechanisms and stuff, I want to make it very clear that the epigenomes vary greatly between species, probably more so maybe than even the genomes do. And as a consequence, what does this mean? It means that ultimately we've got to find those genes that are most susceptible or epigenetically labile within the species that we are, at least I seem to be most interested in, which are humans. And that means that a lot of studies, epidemiological studies and epigenetic studies, have to be done ultimately in human populations. It's more difficult to do this, but one doesn't have the problem of extrapolation because you're dealing with the species that we're obviously most interested in. And I'm not saying that other species are not important, but from the standpoint of diseases and stuff, that's what we're interested in.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you sharing your research and your thoughts with us and with our listeners. Eva Jablonka is a professor at Tel Aviv University and co-author of several books, including Evolution in Four Dimensions, Genetic, Epigenetic, Behavioral, and Symbolic Variation in the History of Life. Randy Jertle is a professor at Duke University and the University of Wisconsin and co-author of Environmental Epigenetics and Health and Disease, Epigenetics and Complex Diseases. Patrick McGowan is a professor of neuroscience at the University of Toronto, studying epigenetic changes in the brain. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.